it's a little bit like, you know, a lung cancer patient who's been smoking, you know, 20 packs of Marlboro Reds for 60 years. And you kind of go, hey, you need to stop smoking. Like, that ship has sailed. Like, there's no, you know, once you get federal spending at 25% of GDP and debt at 120% of GDP and deficits at 7% of GDP, and most of those 7% of GDP at, oh, no, by the way, 7% of GDP at all-time record tax receipts inflated by an everything bubble that's now deflated is, okay, we need to cut spending. Okay, how much should we cut spending? Well, historically, we've gone into recessions with 2% of GDP debt to GDP or deficits of GDP. Well, we're at 7. So let's cut, you know, and actually we're probably closer to 9 now, but let's just use 7. We'll cut 5 points of GDP out. You cut 5 points of GDP out, the great financial crisis, GDP fell 5%. You're done. It's really a question of how do you want to light the fuse? That's the only question left.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. With the aggressive return of higher interest rates, the gargantuan piles of debt that world nations owe to each other suddenly become a lot more worrisome. Higher interest rates means higher debt service costs, which means less money left over for governments to fund their operations. Today's guest, macro analyst Luke Grohman, has long warned that the world has been heading into a massive sovereign debt crisis. Have today's rising rates just accelerated the day of reckoning? And what will such a reckoning look like? To find out, let's turn to Luke. Luke, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back on, Adam. It's great to be here again.
Well, thanks. Thanks for joining us at year end. Happy holidays. I see the decorations in your background here. Hope you and your family are getting ready to enjoy some great winter holidays. I got a number of questions here for you, but let's just start with the high level one I like to ask you at the beginning of these interviews. What is your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
My assessment of the global economy and the financial markets are a little bit, I think, akin to the story of the guy who gets pushed off or falls off or jumps off the Empire State Building and, you know, 60 stories down is heard to say, well, so far, so good.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of where we are. And so you see a lot of commentary. Hey, the Fed's having success bringing inflation down sequentially. Agree. Hey, the Fed has done this without blowing anything up. Agree if we add a yet to the end of it. There was a chart a couple weeks ago that was going around Twitter a lot. It still is, which is Fed remittances to the U.S. Treasury. And basically it shows sort of this, I don't know, 10, 15 year trend of very steady remittances of the Federal Reserve back to the Treasury. Because basically any, by virtue of the Fed's portfolio, any excess profits earned from their bond portfolio that they've held since 2008 when they started QE in earnest, gets remitted back to Treasury. And so there's this very steady profit profile. And my understanding is the Fed has never in 100 plus years in existence ever run an operating loss. And then all of a sudden in August, these remittances, which are basically a proxy for excess earnings, retained earnings for the Fed, operating profits for the Fed, collapse. I mean, not just slow, they literally fall off a cliff, fall off the table, and they are still falling. Now, this is widely expected. You had people warning about it. The Fed has done papers on it. And so it's not one of these aha, oh gosh, moments from a standpoint of, you know, the Fed's going to go broke. The Fed can't go broke. The Fed is upside down. They're accounting for them as a deferred asset, right? Wouldn't we all love to take our losses and use them as a deferred, carry them as a deferred asset on our books, which in some levels we do, right? You can carry it forward. Carry loss forwards, but you can't go get a loan at the bank with your deferred losses from the dot-com boom. But my point is this, in terms of the initial story regarding he's fallen off the building, he's 60 stories down, so far so good, which is the Fed has on, at its core, the Fed has on the same portfolio, the same position that a very big stretch of the U.S. economy has on, which is borrow short, lend long. And now they're losing money because they're upside down as a, by virtue of the lagged impact of these interest rates. And the Fed is down about $1 trillion, $1.2 trillion on their portfolio, which again, they don't have to mark to market. So it's good for them, you know. However, there is some enormous stretch of the mark to, of the borrow short, lend long, financialized U.S. and global economy that does not have the luxury of taking ups, you know, operating losses and accruing for them as an asset. They don't have the luxury of not having to mark to market their losses. And so you're starting to see symptoms of this in the global borrow short, lend long world. When you see in the FT last week, zombie New York real estate office space, there is a bid ask spread that has blown out. The offer side is like, it's still valued here. And the bid side is far lower. And so far, it's basically been a Mexican standoff between the offer side and the bid side since 2020. These rates rising are going to force that to a head. We've seen it in housing. We've seen it in the gating of the Blackstone Fund, a real estate fund. We've seen it in the gating of the Starwood Fund last week. So you're starting to see these symptoms of the Fed. What has happened to the Fed's balance sheet has happened to every balance sheet that is borrow short, lend long on in some way, or virtually every. You're setting aside hedges, et cetera. The hedges roll off. You have to refinance. Refinancing costs are up meaningfully because of what rates have done. And so that's why I say it's like, you know, falling or 60 stories down so far, so good. It's like, well, yeah, but it's not the fall that kills you. It's a sudden stop. And my point is in the first half of 23, we're going to start seeing the sudden stop metaphorically, where you're going to go from the offer side. They're going to show up to refinance and realize we can't refinance. Hit the bid. And once we start hitting bids on a blown out offer, you know, bid-ask spread, it suggests risks of very binary shifts to asset prices, economic activity, in big stretches of the financialized economy. So that is, I think, the nickel tour, or the, you know, the 3 minute, 5 minute summary of where I think we are as we're sitting here today.
Okay, so it sort of sounds like you're saying the timer's been set here, right? There's a reckoning. What's been put in place? While we can, you know, something massive hasn't broken yet. Fed's been able to get away with hiking and tightening longer than many thought it could. But you're saying it's not going to escape the reckoning. That the timer is still ticking down towards that moment. all right, so. You have been one of the more vocal people out there to really talk about the debt crisis at a sovereign level. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about, you know, the weaker players first, right? It's usually, you know, zombie companies and things like that, that are super overextended, that die first. You know, nations, because they, in many cases, have their own printing presses, die last. But where are we in this sort of sovereign debt crisis story? Like, you're a big baseball fan, you know, sort of like what inning are we in, and what are sort of the next material developments you expect to see at the sovereign level?
I think we are in probably the sixth inning, maybe. We saw it accelerate meaningfully throughout most of 2022 with the energy crisis. And you saw, obviously, we've seen a number of emerging markets with problems, but you saw it in energy short developed markets, right? We saw it in Europe, we saw it in Japan, we saw it in the UK. And those were getting very acute by the end of September, when we had the pension crisis in the UK, and the yen getting quite disorderly on the downside. And I think there has been a little bit of time bought. It's interesting. We've taken some guff for saying we thought the Fed would pivot by end of September, and they didn't explicitly pivot. Now, what's really interesting is if you look at what the Fed has done in terms of rates, they didn't pivot with QT, they didn't pivot. If you look at what has happened to reverse repo balances, which have dropped meaningfully since the end of September, if you look at the Treasury General account, which has dropped meaningfully since the end of September, there has been a de facto liquidity injection since late September, mid-October, that has sort of bought time. It's weakened the dollar, and that has taken pressure off of the UK. It's taken pressure off of Japan, Europe to a lesser extent. So we've been moving along. Energy accelerated it because basically these nations needed energy. They needed to sell treasuries to buy energy, to oversimplify. And so you were getting disorderly treasury markets through September. So it was accelerating. This sort of liquidity injection has bought us time. I think we're in the sixth inning because now I think it's going to start reaccelerating again based on what the U.S. Treasury came out and said at the end of October, which was on August 1st, 2022, U.S. Treasury came out and said we're going to need to borrow $400 billion for 4Q22. And 3 months later, they came out and said, oops, that's $550 billion. So they took the borrowing estimate up 37% in 3 months. And what changed, I think, was a significant deterioration in the U.S.'s fiscal picture. And what that means is that's why I say we're getting into the sixth inning now and beyond in the later innings, because now when you add what the increase to the fourth quarter estimate and the first quarter 23 estimate, it implies that for the next 6 months, U.S. deficit is going to rise from $1.3 trillion annualized this year to $2.6 trillion annualized next year. The deficit's exploding. And so you're going to have this significant increase in issuance. You've seen November's tax receipts in the United States have actually come down. They're now down year over year. The comps get much, much harder. The economy is still having a lagged impact. You've seen the biggest state in the, 15% of U.S. tax receipts, California, has gone from a record surplus in May to a massive deficit by November. So there's been this dynamic of it's been over there and it's all fun and games until it takes tax receipts down year over year. And once it starts hitting tax receipts, it has treasury issuance up. Once treasury issuance goes up, then one of two things happens is you're either going to have to pull in capital from elsewhere to drive or to finance that, in which case that implies sort of selling in other global dollar markets, asset markets, dollar up to attract the capital, or the Fed's got to come in and start, easing off to weaken the dollar to make treasuries more attractive to foreign. So you're coming up to this key decision point. And the key decision point is being driven by the U.S. fiscal situation, which is occurring basically right around when we would have thought. You had this liquidity injection that kept it going October into November, but here we are. So from here, things start to get interesting with the with U.S. tax receipts beginning to decline and likely to decline more and potentially non-linearly if we have a collective or sequential moving in the borrow short lend long part of the world from the ask side to the bid side.
All right, this is exactly where I wanted to get into with you, which is great. So U.S. fiscal situation seems to be deteriorating and deteriorating quite quickly. You haven't even mentioned the word recession yet, but there's good likelihood that we could be entering one next year. I do want to ask you about your outlook about that in just a little bit. But before we even get there, you're saying tax receipts are going down, right? And you just mentioned California's flip from big surplus to now big deficit. And I live in California. A ton of our state tax receipts come from capital gains, both in financial markets and in the housing market. And as everybody knows, 2022 has been a bad year for all of those. The bear market could continue next year. Again, I'm going to add further then, which would just exacerbate the situation. But let's stick for a minute just on the cost of debt, right? So the Fed has dramatically hiked interest rates this year. You have been warning for a long time about the increasing amount of liabilities and entitlements and how when you kind of add everything together, there's not much left over And I know you've been worried about how that gap is getting worse as time goes on. But now it's been potentially dramatically accelerated by the increase in interest rates, because just the interest on the federal debt becomes that much more of a problem. What are the latest numbers on that? Like, how much has it increased over this year?
Yeah. So if I think it's important to note that, yes, we had a bubble in everything in assets, but it remains poorly understood that the bubble, the everything bubble and the inflation were also driving a bubble in tax receipts. And that, whatever it was, 40% increase in tax receipts in 2021 and into 2022 allowed U.S. what I call true interest expense, treasury spending plus the pay-as-you-go portion of entitlements, to fall, to be back below 100% of tax receipts. In 2020, 2021, early part, certainly, the U.S.'s true interest expense was above tax receipts. And then right. You layer on that.
And sorry to interrupt, but you're saying we basically juiced tax receipts by creating the asset bubble.
Yes.
Right. But also in doing that, to do that, we brought interest rates down to historic lows, which also kept the interest component of the rising debt pile under control. And now we've got the exact reverse of that. So I just want to make sure folks understood, but continue.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, now you're going in the opposite direction. So you've got treasury spending, which was $1 trillion, give or take, last year, about a third, a little less than a third of U.S. treasury debt will reprice within the year. So you figure a third of 24 trillion of net debt, realistically, you probably should use a 30, but we use 24 to be conservative. So that's 800 billion, and that's probably going to be up 300 basis points year over year alone. So, right. So there's a quarter trillion right there, which is, you know, about 40%, 30% of the defense budget right off the top. Right. You've got the cost of living adjustment for Social Security alone for next year is going to be another 120 billion. You're going to have another swing factor from the Fed, who, remember, we were talking about the Fed remitting, operating gains above its operating cost, or gains above its operating costs, back to Treasury. That's gone away because they've gone into a loss position. That's another 110 billion, right? So there's, like, right off the top, without even having to work or break a sweat, I can get a 40, 50% increase in the deficit year over year right there. At the same time, tax receipts are now down. They're going to get a lot worse unless there's some sort of massive liquidity injection that continues or accelerates. Because of what the Fed has done, and because of the difficult everything bubble tax receipt comps from a year ago, and so the punchline to it is, I think we're about to see Treasury spending as a percent of tax receipts, which peaked out at like 110% in 2021, early 2021, they fell to 85-88%, maybe 90% of tax receipts. They're going to probably get back above 100% of tax receipts at some point next year, probably late in the first half, early in the second half. Once that happens, you're into a situation where the Fed's got to either print the difference, or which is dollar negative and risk positive, or the resulting, basically the U.S. Treasury is going to crowd out global dollar markets. And so you're going to see the regime we saw this year, which is rates, you know, all else equal, dollar up, rates up, everything else down. And it gets to a very binary situation. So we're rapidly accelerating toward that. And the pace at which the Fed has hiked and the lagged impact of those hikes are merely going to accelerate that, not just accelerate it, but probably make it very nonlinear in the first half of next year.
All right. And I'm sorry, can you clarify that second? So you said basically once tax receipts, once expenses get above 100% of tax receipts, there's two choices. One is the Fed has to print the difference, which we all understand. We know that game really well. Mm-hmm. What was the other one?
And basically, we let free markets set the price of borrowing for the U.S. government, right? So basically, they say, all right, we end up with a situation where federal deficit, let's say, runs at $2.6 trillion next year, right? The next 6 months are going to run at that rate. So let's just annualize that, $2.6 trillion in Treasury sales from the Treasury. The Fed, QT, 95 billion a month. There's another nearly 1.2 trillion. So for easy math, there's 3.8. As the dollar rises, foreigners in the last 8 months have sold at a 400 foreign central banks and foreigners in total about at a 400 billion rate. So annualize that, say another trillion two. So now you're up to 1.26. What 1.2 is 3.8. Another 1.2 is 5 trillion in net treasury sales. So basically, you're going to be looking at, if the Fed says no, we're going to push on, you're going to be looking at possibly likely at least 5 trillion in net treasury sales next year, which is fine. But now the free markets are going to dictate the rate that gets done at, the dollar price that gets done at, and that's going to drive the dollar up because you're crowding out global dollar markets, basically, right? Because treasuries are going to crowd out all other markets. You're probably going to see what we had this year, which is there are a lot of people, particularly in the second half of this year, that said, wow, look, you know, Michael Guyad had this great chart showing that this is the first time in 65 years that U.S. Treasury bonds in a top 20 drawdown ever for stocks, Treasury bonds, a TLT, sold off more than stocks did. Even in the inflationary 70s, treasuries outperformed stocks in the sell-offs, in the big sell-offs. This is the first time in 65 years that didn't happen. And it's not a surprise to me at all. I was a little surprised that we didn't get sort of this bid we're having for treasuries now. First, we didn't. It just went right to the sell-off. Now we're getting a little bit of a respite, but you've got this massive mismatch of at least a net $5 trillion in supply. The problem is the economy is going to be slowing as this happens. As the economy slows, the available balance sheet, right, shrinks because global GDP growth shrinks. So there's less new capital to buy this $5 trillion. This $5 trillion is going to be way more than global GDP growth in 2023, particularly if rates keep rising. So you're into this problem of not enough balance sheet. And if there's not enough balance sheet, you're going to have dollar up, you're going to have rates up, and now you're into a death spiral because now
right,
that's going
that
to
slows the
faster
economy
and faster
even more.
And so this, like, that's why I say we're in the sixth inning, maybe seventh inning, is these things don't go linearly. Like, you know, in April, the gilt market in the UK was fine. In September, it was like, oh my God, all hands on deck, fire. And the 10-year gilt was going vertical. This same kind of thing can happen in the treasury market very easily. And if it happens in the treasury market, it's going to happen everywhere. Because it sits atop sort of the capital stack. And my guess is you'd see gold do really well too, because gold will start sniffing out, like, you know, above a certain rate, the U.S. government can't afford it. And okay, you know, get me some gold too, because they're not going to let that happen.
Okay. So I'm going to restate what you said, just really simply trying to help folks understand. So once our national costs exceed our 100% of our tax receipts, the Treasury basically has to sell treasuries to fund the difference. And in one scenario, the Fed will buy them, right? They'll print and buy them. They will be the marginal buyer and kind of the cost insensitive buyer. Like they'll keep rates nice and low and they'll absorb all that. Or Powell is going to do what he says he's doing, which is, nope, we got to get inflation under control. We are still tightening. We're going to keep hiking for as long as we can. Then we're going to pause and we're going to hold steady for a long time. And therefore the Treasury is going to have to sell all that Treasury debt on the open market. And you've just explained what happens, you know, when we do that. But basically rates go up, dollar strengthens further, and it just makes all the issues that we've been having this year get even worse, right? Creates this vicious spiral that you just talked about.
Absolutely. So we did a chart for clients a few weeks back that showed that one way to look at it, because it's difficult to see what global private balance sheet is, right? So you have to try to kind of approximate it, play bigger than a breadbasket to get to a number, just something you can kind of put your mind around. And so one way we looked at it is we said, all right, we're going to go back to the IMF numbers for global GDP and global GDP growth. And then we're going to compare that every year to the nominal dollar federal deficit that year, right? Because again, the U.S. is the global reserve currency. The Treasury has historically been the primary reserve asset for the last 50 years. And so let's look back 27 years, back to 95, what the deficit was, and compare that to the dollar amount of global GDP growth. And what we found was that I think there were 8 instances since 95 where global where the U.S. federal deficit was more than 20% of global GDP growth that year in dollar terms. And every year but one, the Fed was engaged in, every one of those 8 years but one, the Fed was engaged in QE to basically help finance the deficit, to supplement global balance sheet to prevent, except one. The 1 year they didn't do it was last year, or this year, excuse me, 2022, in which we've seen the U.S. federal deficit run around 30% of global GDP growth. Okay, so what does that imply for 2023? Is what we just described is the if you look at the IMF's projected growth for 2023 global GDP growth, which I would take the under on, but set that aside, and then compare that to what just happened to the federal deficit. If we just annualize what Treasury just announced on October 31st, which was, oops, it's not $1.3 trillion, it's 2.6 now. We're running at a 2.6 trillion rate. We use that 2.6 trillion annual rate. What we find is that annual rate is over 60% of the projected global IMF GDP growth for 2023. And I would take the under on that number.
Wow.
So if you liked 2022, which was dollar up, treasuries down, stocks down, bonds down, like everything down, you're going to love 2023 because it's 60%. It is. And that's why I say, I think we're in the sixth or seventh inning. Like, this thing's going to come to a head very quickly, in my view. And I think it's going to start, like I said before, in sort of these borrow short, lend long things that all probably look like the Fed's operating. You know, to me, the Fed's operating statement is just a cautionary tale.
Okay. I do find it somewhat funny in a gallows humor way that when we talk about the options, right, of cost exceeding tax receipts, that it's, we just assume the U.S. Treasury has to print up a whole bunch to fill the hole, and it's either the Fed or the market that buys it. There is a third option, which is that we just choose to do less and live within our means. I see you laughing. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy that that's not even on the table, and I agree that it's just not going to happen. All right,
well, it's so even worse than that. I mean, because really, you can't. Yeah, it's a little bit like, you know, a lung cancer patient who's been smoking, you know, 20 packs of Marlboro Reds for 60 years. And you kind of go, hey, you need to stop smoking. Like, that ship has sailed. Like, there's no, you know, once you get federal spending at 25% of GDP and debt at 120% of GDP and deficits at 7% of GDP, and most of those 7% of GDP at, oh, no, by the way, 7% of GDP at all-time record tax receipts inflated by an everything bubble that's now deflated is, okay, we need to cut spending. Okay, how much should we cut spending? Well, historically, we've gone into recessions with 2% of GDP debt to GDP or deficits of GDP. Well, we're at 7. So let's cut, you know, and actually we're probably closer to 9 now, but let's just use 7. We'll cut 5 points of GDP out. You cut 5 points of GDP out, the great financial crisis, GDP fell 5%. You're done. So it's really a question of how do you want to light the fuse? That's the only question left. Because if you do that, GDP is going to fall rapidly. And when it falls rapidly with debt to GDP where it is, you know, you run into the same problem from a different angle.
Oh, that is very depressing there, Luke.
I didn't make the decisions. I just count them. I'm just counting the totals.
No, I know. Well, look, okay. But before we get to the point where the patient literally dies, I want to see if this issue about the rising interest rate, the rising debt service cost alone, could that be the factor that forces the Fed pivot?
I guess it could. I think it's just part of the federal deficit side where, when you put it together with sort of everything else.
Let me make the question a higher level question, which could it be this deficit now, right, that we're now over 100% of tax receipts? Could that reality be what forces Powell to have to deviate from what he has said he's going to do? Hey, you know what? We're going to have to print up these treasuries, or, you know, issue these treasuries. I guess I got to step in to fix things here.
Yeah, I don't think he wants to, but I think that's ultimately what it was always going to be, right? I think we were seeing that those concerns start to reach a crescendo in September and into October with the, you know, the volatility index in treasuries, you know, this heightened discussion of treasury buybacks that was happening, the problems the UK had, the problems Japan was having with the yen. You were seeing all of this accelerate very meaningfully. And then we had this IMF meeting in mid-October in Washington. And all of a sudden, I don't know what was said, but in that time, in the intervening period, we have had these liquidity injections. The dollar has gone from 114 to 104. The treasury market has been bid. You've seen this respite.
Yeah. And sorry to interrupt, but was this just sort of the rest of the world getting in a room with America and saying, you're killing me, Smalls, right? This high dollar is just, it's strangling us. We need you to bring the dollar down a little bit to give us some respite here.
I think it was at the end of the day. Yeah. I think it was a short and one-sided conversation. With Yellen and I think some of it too is like, listen, you say you want to compete with China, you say you want us allied with Russia, you're putting a bullet in us first. And so unless you want to put a bullet in us and take on the Chinese and Russians yourself, you better get the dollar down. You better, because otherwise things are going to get real chaotic from here. And so I think we've bought time, but I think, you know, the TGA is finite. The reverse repo balances are finite. There is still some runway on the reverse repo balances, but they're finite. And they're reserves, right? So they're not going to have to run all the way to zero. They're not going to run the TGA all the way to zero, in my opinion. Reverse repo, though, isn't going to get to zero before markets start seeing through like, uh-oh, like what comes next. So they do have some levers, but I think it's ultimately this fiscal situation, the interest broadly defined, right? When you start having the borrow short, lend long world, whose P&L statement has to look like what the Fed's operating statement looks like, these remittances, which is, hey, everything's great, crash. That's fine. They can go for a little bit. At some point, they have to refinance. And when they go to refinance, from here to here, the bank's going to go, we need margin. And they're going to go, we're done.
Yeah,
and that's just going to happen across that whole world. That's going to replay into tax receipts. And so we're looking at a world where in the first half of next year, we get more of these treasury statements, which go from, oops, we thought we were going to borrow 400. Now, oops, it's 550. And then in 1Q, we thought we were going to borrow 5. Oops, it's 7. And 2Q, we thought was going to be 6, and it's 900 billion. And that gets into this treasury issuance number relative to the available balance sheet question. And that will not be a linear conversation. That will be like, everything's great. Holy cow. We have a full on crisis.
That's the, you're fine falling until you actually impact the pavement as you start this conversation with. So I just want to make sure that folks are getting kind of the complexity of the storyline here, because there are challenges that we have domestically that Luke has done a good job of laying out here. But we have to remember that, you know, we're not the only player in what's going on here, right? And to the point you made about, we have, I mean, the world has become more bifurcated very quickly post Russia invasion of Ukraine. And I talked a lot about that with Felix Zuloff in my interview with him last week, so we don't need to go too much into that here, Luke. But have its strategy succeed going forward, you know, the U.S. basically needs Team America to support it, you know, versus this you know, Russia-China block that's becoming a bit more defined, right? And basically, what you're saying is. The rest of Team America says, hey, look, if you want it to be Team America, you want it to be America plus a team, you got to help us out here because you're killing the team right now, bro. Right? Also, to a certain extent, you know, you're saying, look, we because of our domestic issues, we are going to have to start selling more treasuries than we planned. And who are we going to sell those to? Well, we're largely going to sell them to, you know, people outside the U.S. And so if we expect these guys to be able to buy what we're issuing, they got to be in a state to be able to do that, right? We can't kill them beforehand, right? So it's just, it's quite complex. You're nodding as I'm saying this, so I feel I haven't screwed up too much of what I've just said, Luke. There's one other issue too, just to understand again how complex this is again, talking to Felix Zuloff, you know, I was sort of asking him what, when we talked about like things that could really break, that could force the Fed and the other major central banks to change policy, you know, he said, you know, it could very well be something that happens outside the U.S. that creates contagion that then becomes a problem big enough that it impacts the U.S. In his mind, he thought China was a candidate right at the top of that list, just given the huge issues that they're having there, the defaults in their real estate market and whatnot. And because so many other, you know, world banks are, you know, invested in Chinese real estate, it's the world's biggest asset, that it could create a banking crisis that eventually blows back. And even though we didn't start it, you know, it's something that we have to react to. So I guess what I'm just trying to emphasize for folks here is the fact that it is a very enmeshed game of many different players. And we can look at our specific situation here in the U.S., but we can't look at it in isolation. We've got to take it in mind, both with our allies and with our potential adversaries.
I think that's right. And I think it's further intensified or made more complex because I don't think there is a Team America. I think there is factions within the U.S., factions within Europe, factions within China, and they're all fighting with each other and externally, right? So I think in the U.S., you have this, for example, what I've referred to as the make bonds great again crowd, right? Which is sort of, you know, Powell, Fed, Dudley, Summers, which are sort of raise rates until everything breaks and as high as it has to go, it's good. You know, unemployment, send it up. If we have to do a depression, whatever it takes, right? It's sort of the Andrew Mellon school of monetary policy, right? Liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, purge the rottenness from the system. Okay. They are, I think, wrong because that they don't realize the very thing they're trying to defend will break if they do that nominally. You know, basically for the reasons we touched on, is tax receipts will collapse so much they won't be able to make the interest payment on the debt. But that's a separate discussion. That's one faction. Then you have this other faction, which is sort of strange bedfellows of sort of the MMT wing of the Fed and Treasury, right? Leo Brainard and others. I think parts of the military and defense establishment where you know, they when you go to defense and intelligence, they don't think in terms of the next election strictly. They're thinking strategically, actually, which, you know, and what they're looking at is going, we're being asked to potentially fight China using weapons and components made in China. This makes no sense. Well, okay, why, you know, and they take a step back and go, why is that the case? And the answer is the financial system, the monetary system. And they say, okay, well, that has to change. So, well, how do we change it? Well, we have to restructure the dollar system. So the dollar is still a reserve currency, but there's a neutral reserve asset that is not treasuries anymore. Because as long as a neutral reserve asset is our treasuries, our job is to run deficits and export treasuries. And the more we do that, we're not going to make stuff. The Chinese are... So you've got sort of, you know, for example, in the U.S., this wing of, okay, the make bonds great again group against the sort of the realists of, okay, we did a bunch of dumb stuff and this isn't working for us anymore. So now we need to inflate. In Europe, you've got sort of the Atlanticist wing where, hey, you know, whatever the Americans tell us to do, we do. You know, if they tell us to jump off a bridge, we go jump off a bridge. And then there were the realists of like, the Russians are there. They've got all this cheap energy. We need cheap energy to compete with the Chinese. Let's do that. And we've obviously seen those competing wings that has broken down. That's been something that's been very fractured over the last 6 months for a number of different reasons. China, you've got sort of the, you know, the domestic export centric classic power structure against the, you know, wanting to move away from that and hardliners, you know, harder liners within their political establishment. So, not only do you have the dynamics with the countries, but then you have them, the dynamics within each of the major players fighting against each other. So there's, you know, for me, it's a very, very chaotic time to try to analyze things. There are no clear, there's no clear answers about a whole lot at the moment.
Okay. It is a challenging time. I don't envy the position you're in, having to try to really pierce the veil of all this smoke. But it's great that we've got folks like you that are smart guys like you that are doing this to help guide us. Couple quick more macro questions before we get into the kind of your market outlook. Maybe we call this the rapid fire section, because I think we could probably talk all day about each one of these topics here. when we talked, and you already gave some nod to this, last time we talked, you were not sure that the Fed was going to make it through Q3 before it was going to be forced to reverse policy. Obviously, they've been able to extend it longer than you think. Do you still think a pivot is the more likely outcome here?
Ultimately, yes. Like I said before, the liquidity injection came from Treasury and from reverse repo. It wasn't an explicit pivot. There was a liquidity injection that has bought time. That is a temporary buying of time, in my view. So yes, I still think that we are heading towards things getting more critical in the next probably 3 to 6 months.
Okay. All right. another way to answer that or ask that question is Powell's stated objective of, we're going to keep hiking for a couple quarters, we're going to get up at above 5-ish%, and then we're going to hold steady for a long period of time. You are not betting on that scenario playing out to the length that he is selling it right now.
No, as one of my best relationships on Wall Street, veteran macro trader, said the U.S. government's insolvent at 5.
Okay. All right. Last time,
and they're not the only ones, by the way. Everybody's
well, yeah, absolutely, right? Yeah. And that's what I think most people forget. It's a different world from what we experienced back during the Volcker era, right? Where we just have so much more debt now, right? I mean, in the Volcker era, America was still a net creditor, right? Yeah. So
give or take, it was a push, but they were a little bit of a deficit, but it was like tiny,
tiny,
okay. Tiny.
And then by the time the 08 crisis rolled around, I'm remembering the exact number of outstanding debt. I think it might've been 9 trillion. I think it was 9 trillion.
Yeah. It was like 50, 60% of GDP. Something like
that. And now we're at 31 trillion more, right? Yeah. And that's just the federal debt load, right? In the US, right? So the debt piles around the world are just so much higher at this point, where, you know, we can withstand a lot less of a interest rate before all the knock-on effects that you were talking about earlier really become unsustainable for the system, right? So, all right. Also, last time we talked, you described in depth, so we won't go into great detail on it here, but how China was sort of conducting this LBO of the world. And it probably was the biggest fan of the dollar system, because it was using it to, you know, be our manufacturing hub, take all those dollars and then reinvest them in buying the world's resources, right? Has that strategy been shaken up, how much has that strategy been shaken up in the wake of the Ukraine war and the changing trade lines and the now at least focus on reshoring and friendshoring? We are seeing more and more companies looking like they are getting more and more of their manufacturing out of China. Some of it might still stay in Asia, but some of it may be going elsewhere. Is that board game getting pretty mixed up at this point, or is it going to take a long time?
I think it's a slow, steady slog. I think the Ukraine situation in some ways complicated it. But I mean, look, last Friday, she was in Saudi Arabia, and the headlines on Reuters are that she proposes to MBS to buy energy in yuan from Saudi Arabia. Headline nobody ever thought we would see. We saw it. Now, why did we see it? What we saw it because China's buying 30% of Saudi's oil, because China's the world's biggest oil importer, because even being the world's biggest oil importer, China still uses one sixth per capita of the oil that the United States did in 2021. So there's a lot of runway. So, you know, you look at the reception that she got relative to the reception that Biden got. Biden got a fist bump. Mm-hmm. She had an escort of 3 fighter jets on either side who then circled around after his plane, a 747, importantly, an American-made 747, was on the ground, right? So obviously we're not there yet. But after his flight, the Saudi Arabian flights go by, and they have smoke canisters in the color of the Chinese flag, like that the fact that all of that happened is I think just sort of a milestone. That wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. That wouldn't have happened 20 years ago for sure. 30 years, 40 years, never. So it's like being in, you know, sitting outside of a glass conference room and seeing a meeting is happening, but you can't hear it. You can hear they're talking, but you can't hear it. And every now and then someone leaves the conference room and you hear clearly what's being said and you get some sense. And then, you know, and sort of what happened last week, I think, was one of those moments where the conference room door swung open and we see, like, okay. I mean, the very fact that there was even a debate around the meaning of yuan oil, the Saudi and yuan, that in and of itself is a milestone. Because 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it would have been laughed at. I know, because I was being laughed at for saying it was heading this way and people thought I was nuts. They're not laughing anymore. So I think some of it is a little self-referential from the standpoint is like China is doing this partly because they have the power to now do this by virtue of their size and the way this has evolved and their dollar surpluses, et cetera. Part of why China is doing this is out of desperation, because this whole thing blows up on them if they don't gain the ability to import all those commodities in their own currency, because that gives them another lever to manage their balance of payments, to make sure right. They don't run into a currency crisis. So there's these, I think it is still moving in that direction. You've seen some things have helped it. I think others have hurt it. I mean, obviously their shutdowns this year with COVID have been, I think a huge net negative for them. You sort of has moved them now into survival mode. Now they look to be rolling those things off. Let's see. What does that mean? You start seeing Chinese oil. I mean, oil's $75 with China heavily shut down. What's oil if China's reopened?
China reopens.
And what does that do to the Fed, who's starting to break stuff anyway? If oil reaccelerates from here, now what? The Fed's going to face this choice again in first half of that they last faced in the second half of 07, which is, oh God, the financialized U.S. economy's breaking. We need to cut rates. At the same time as, oh God, oil's rising. We need to raise rates because it's going to filter through to inflation.
Right.
And now choose. Are you really willing to blow up the financialized U.S. economy? They keep saying they are, but I'm not so sure.
Okay. Luca, I want to have you back on and dig more deeply when we do into kind of your longer view of if the world is indeed becoming, again, more bipolar, who you think has the better odds on a relative basis from where they are today, Team America, America, West, and friends, or Team Russia, China, BRICS, maybe. But I understand that is a much deeper exploration than for me to force you to give a quick little soundbite on it. So let's trundle over into the market outlook side of things. So if I take anything from what you've said so far, it's lots of uncertainty going into next year and highly dependent upon if and when the Fed pivots here. So for the capital managers, fund managers who are stewarding lots of capital, as well as just for the individual investor, the folks that are watching, this program, it's a hard year to say, man, how do I position myself going in here? What is your general market outlook for 2023? Does the bear market that started this year, does it continue? Do we see new lows next year or different ballgame?
I think the first quarter to half of next year are going to be tough.
Our interview with Luke will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it, and be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And remember, we're continuing our practice of publishing my top takeaways from these weekly interviews. To get mine from this interview with Luke for free, just go to wealthion.com/Adam's Notes. And finally, if the challenging macro outlook Luke has detailed in this interview has you feeling a little nervous about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no-strings-attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends and risks that Luke has mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next in part two of our interview with Luke Groman. Thank you.